Hey, welcome to another episode of the FASD Family Life Podcast. I'm your host, Robbie Seal, and I'm an FASD educator, advocate, and mom of five incredible people, including three teens diagnosed with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. And if my 30 years of parenting has taught me anything, it's that the struggle is real and so is success. Do you love the FASD Family Life Podcast? Well, then I invite you to click the link in the show notes to buy me a cup of coffee and support the show. Thank you very much. In this third season of the FASD Family Life Podcast, I'm having a lot of fun. I called it Mom Talk, and I invited other moms raising children and youth with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder to join me for a coffee and a chat about real life, real struggles, and real successes. It is my hope that by listening to our conversations, that you have the sense that you're not alone, that we all get things wrong, and we find out that when we know better, we can do better. In this episode, I have a conversation with Jackie Pye. Jackie Pye is not a mom of individuals who have FASD, but rather she is actually one of the lead researchers for CAN-FASD, the Canadian FASD Research Network. Dr. Jacqueline Pye is a professor at the Department of Educational Psychology and assistant clinical professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Alberta, also a practicing registered psychologist for the past 18 years. Dr. Pye began her career as a criminologist and forensic counselor working with incarcerated youth. Motivated by this early work, she returned to academia to study youth at risk, child development, and neuropsychology. Her current focus includes identification and evaluations of interventions to support healthy outcomes for youth put at risk, and in particular, individuals with fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. Dr. Pye has over 75 peer-reviewed publications, but places the greatest value on her work with various community and government agencies. To this end, Dr. Pye currently leads the Intervention Network Action Team, and is the senior research lead for Canada FASD Research Network, roles that facilitates the link between research, policy, and practice. I invited Dr. Jackie Pye to join me here for Mom Talk. I know she's not raising kids with FASD, but trust me, y'all, she gets it. She understands fetal alcohol spectrum disorder, and she's got a love and a passion for this community. And she has done so much research to point us in the direction of how is it that we have better outcomes for our kids. And that's what this conversation is all about. Please stay tuned till the very end of the episode, because I want to talk with you about what's coming up in September. September is FASD Awareness Month. September 9th is the International Day for FASD, where we recognize this disability. And there's activities happening all over to raise awareness of FASD. In Canada, we're encouraging our public spaces to light up red as an FASD awareness and to celebrate the strengths and the abilities of individuals who have fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. As well, RunFASD 2022 is a really exciting opportunity for all of us to walk, run, or roll, however we want to do it, to raise awareness and funds for fetal alcohol spectrum disorder. There's going to be details at the end of the show that I want you to really pay attention to, because it's such a cool initiative. All right, let's get into the episode with Dr. Jacqueline Pye as we talk Mom Talk. As you've been thinking about this, if anything,
I'm kind of really in the zone of what we were just talking about, throwing some of the old thinking out the door and embracing the ability to be a relational parent and not thinking that you have to be the, you know, authoritarian, I'm the boss, I'm in charge parent, but rather be a relational parent who, you know, works with their child to find the solutions and the pathways forward and doesn't, you know, I think that's a really interesting conversation. And I don't think it's an easy one, because even then, where do you set the bar? And when do you set the bar? When do you say no? When do you, like, there's still parameters for all of these things. So it's never an easy conversation, but I think it's a really exciting conversation, because I think it really opens the door to what it means to parent very differently for all of us.
We all need that shift. I think we all need that shift. I said earlier, when I started parenting, it was in the 1991, and I was very much behavior modification and environment forms everything. Nurture is going to win over nature and all that kind of stuff. And in 30 years later, I'm like, No, that didn't work out that way. That's not actually how it works.
Imagine that, right?
Imagine that. So my firstborn, as all of us, our firstborn are always the experiment. And I'm like, oh, well, that didn't go according to plan. She's wonderful. But her spending the first 12 years in time out and in grounding was not effective. You know, and so now as my 30-year-old adult daughter, it's a lot, of course, it's a lot more relational. I'm not doing that top-down parenting, but as I'm with my teenagers still, have really shifted away from you have to be on my team and do it my way according to my standards and my morals and my personality. Rather, let me slow down and be quiet and watch who you really are. Take into account what your developmental level is, what your temperament is, what your personality is, what your sensory processing needs are, and then let me attune and be on your team to guide your development. And it's been transformative.
You know, when we accept that there's difference, and I mean, that's for any child, and then you add on something like FASD, and you know, then individuals are really, truly, their brains are wired up differently. They're seeing, experiencing, and interacting with the world differently than we are. So to assume that we can employ the same strategies or things even that we think, well, this worked fine for me, but we're very, very different. And so to be able to assume a role of a observer and learner and watching what's going on, you know, it's interesting. I've probably talked about this with you before, but we've done lots of work around just basic academic learning and math in particular, right? And this is actually relates to parenting. It comes back around, I promise you. But one of the things we're doing is saying, you know, how do we help kids get better in their math? And, oh, what if we use this strategy to teach them? What if we use that strategy? And all these well-known established math strategies. Let's try it. And these kiddos weren't getting any better. Here's all these tools we can give. The kiddos aren't learning. And then what became the most profound approach to supporting kids with FASD to learn math was to actually stop showing them things, stop giving them tools, stop doing that, and actually say, show me how you did that. And so when they made an error in their math, instead of trying to correct, it was like, no, I'm not going to do anything. I want you to show me how you got there, correct or incorrect. Show me your work. Just talk me through it. I do this and you do this. Because all of a sudden you're like, oh, you did what? And it's surprising. And then when you see it, you're like, oh, wait a minute. Now I understand. Oh, let's switch this. Oh, okay. And then we see success. But as long as we think that we already know the answer before we've watched, we miss it. We've got to watch and we've got to accept that maybe until we've observed for a little while, we aren't going to know the answer. And even then, we're not going to necessarily know the answer, but we may have a better idea about where some of the challenges come in. And so anyway, it's one of the major components of sort of the math intervention we do is how to work through kids and the types of errors that they're making and to understand errors, because we've got to watch more. And you just apply that behaviorally to day to day. Just watch.
The time with the kids home during the pandemic, online schooling, was so informative. Mm. For one of my three, it was awful, but that too was informative to see how he struggles and all the support he needs. And for the others, it was really informative to be able to watch them over the day. But as you talked about that math strategy and you're saying, rather than correcting, show me how, that's an invitation to be, like I said earlier, like on your team, show me how. And you're giving respect and trust in that person. That's not the right word, but you're showing respect in a collaboration with them. And I know I learned that a long time ago behaviorally with one of my kids. The kids were dropped off in the school bus and the school bus driver waved me over. And so I come over and you're like, okay, that's not going to be a good moment. Okay, here I am. Your kids were swearing on the bus. Your kids were, and I'm like, okay. So this was a few years ago and I was frustrated, of course, with the kids, because that's not what I was expecting. Everybody get in your room. I'm going to get down to the bottom of this. Rah, rah, rah. And that's the tack I had. But guess what? That didn't go well. And what I realized later on, I was like thinking about myself, okay, kids do well if they can. Thanks. Kids do well if they can. And then I thought, what happened for that child that it didn't go well. And so I came back to her after having her, you're in your room all day. You know, I came back to her and said, you know, I'm really sorry. I'm sorry I handled it that way. And of course, she was very quick to tell me how wrong I was and what a bad mother I was, but that's okay. I was able to say to her, that must have been really hard for you. What happened that you got so upset? So show me how you got here. And it was everything, Jackie, because what she did was she told me kids were bullying her brother on the bus. She tried to put a stop to it by saying, stop picking on my brother. They retaliated. So she says, if you don't stop hurting or don't stop bullying him, I'm going to hurt you, because that's her default. I'm going to hurt you. Yeah. And then they jacked her up, or they responded in kind. And then she started swearing.
Yeah.
But so I had attributed an intent and a maliciousness and all that that wasn't there. When I said, show me how you got here, I realized that was about lagging skill. Her intent was wonderful. It was to protect her brother and to stop this chaos that was going on, but she didn't have the skills. So rather than being assertive, she turned aggressive. But that was all about skills and capacity. And that's it with math too, skills and capacity. So show me how you got here.
And you're right. And it's all skills. Like, it crosses everything. And, you know, and when you ask those questions, like you said, like, that, it's beautiful. So many different things happen. Like, one is you give the individual voice, and suddenly they have a voice. You're helping them even to learn and practice sort of, how do I express, how do I even think about what was going on? Like, that takes a bit of work to kind of story it out. So you're giving them the space, the time, and the ability to do that. And showing them sort of that kind of respect, and that you're just setting a tone that says, no, I think there's more to you than this. So I want to understand, like, there's a tone that takes you away from good kid, bad kid into a more nuanced, understanding of, no, I think there's more to this. So tell me, let me understand, help me to understand. I think that, you know, casts a positive light. It gives them some voice. It gives them some practice trying to think about how to express. So they're actually practicing a skill that we're hoping will grow, right? Like, there's so many different things that start to occur when we engage that. And particularly when we are able to say, when I walk in the room and they say, oh, you're just the worst mom ever. And I say, you know what, I'm going to choose to ignore that. Then I'm also modeling and demonstrating what it means to pick your battles. And they'll be a long way from getting there. But you know what? They're never going to get there if I take every battle that you offer. So I'm going, no, this is something else. I'm not even going to go there. I'm going to try to get more to the heart. And then I'm modeling that. So, I mean, it's layer on layer of the kinds of things that we're creating for our kids in terms of a context by which success might be more realized. And it's that we talked about earlier. It's that relational element, right? It's that relational safety that helps to modulate emotions, helps to bring the emotions down so I can actually use my cognitive processes. It creates safety in my space around me to try new things and step out where I might otherwise have been kind of afraid to, right? It helps me to feel that love. And when I don't always love myself, I look to somebody else, I go, well, they love me. So maybe there's something lovable in here. So that helps. So I'm building all of these skills. Like, I mean, I could go on for days.
I wish you would. This is fantastic.
The research is so good. Like, there's so much to say that these relational approaches where you engage with kids in this way, for any kids, has a positive impact on growth and development. For our kids with FASD, whose way of seeing and interacting with the world is different, it's all the more important we do this, because we really don't understand. We think they don't understand. We keep saying, you don't understand what I expect. No, we don't understand. We don't understand what's going on. We don't understand that they're actually just trying to meet needs. They're trying to function. They're trying to live their best life in a world that makes no sense to them. So when we think they don't make sense and we go, that doesn't make any sense, we think one person didn't make sense. What would it be like living in a world where everybody doesn't make sense to you? Right?
That sounds terrible.
I mean, they're stranger in a strange land. And so they're constantly trying to interpret and adapt and make sense of. Why don't we stop asking them to and just start meeting them where they're at and watching? I love that you said that. Let's just sit back and observe and ask and then say, okay, I'm here. What was it you said to me earlier? I'm on your team.
I'm on your team. And I really, that's a huge shift for me. That's a very big shift for me. And I think it's a big shift for all parents, but really I no longer expect them to be on my team. I no longer expect them to meet my needs. That's a big shift as a parent, as a mom. Maybe you don't think that you do expect your kids to meet your needs, but you do. You expect them to meet some of your relational needs. Maybe you need them to expect, or you expect them to meet some of your performative needs. Like, look at me, I'm a good mom and my kids behave this way. or your needs to, I want to go to a family gathering and I want it to be calm and successful. And I don't want to have to deal with any behaviors. And maybe I want to be seen as a nice, normal family. Well, then don't go because you're not.
Not going to happen.
Not going to happen.
But you,
shifting. Yeah. And it's more than shifting expectations, which I believe in as well. It's more than shifting expectations. It's shifting alliances. I'm actually on your team. And so that's been everything. And that's created a really nice, strong relationship with my teenagers who are 17 years old and my 14-year-old so that we can collaborate then together on how do we make a path forward. At this point, we're moving toward the transition from, okay, we're in school, childhood, adolescence. We're transitioning into being 20 or being out of school, and they don't, and I don't expect them to be adults at 20, but the world does. And what's the bridge? And so I'm trying to cobble together a bridge in a world that's foreign to me. I don't know how to do this. So I'm doing this on their team. What is your capacity? What are your interests? How slow do we go? And what do you need? And I wonder what you could speak to about that in terms of how do we really help our kids transition from this world of adolescence into this early adulthood that can be this chasm our kids fall into?
Yeah. I have no magic wand. You know, I say that all the time and because I have lots of great ideas, but, or I think they are.
Yeah. Let me check on your kids.
You know, and actually, to be honest, none of them are ever my ideas. You know, whenever I say I have a great idea, it's always a great idea that came from a kid I've worked with, always, because they're the ones with the great ideas, asking, being on their team. You know, I think team is a powerful language because team allows for a lot of people. And you know, it's actually language that I often use even with clients, with families I get to work with or with kiddos and look at, and we talk about all your teammates and we say, okay, we're all the team. And what position does everyone play? And we actually talk about that quite a bit to make it, you know, help make it make sense, but also really identify some of the accountability and responsibility that needs to come from teammates. So not only am I on your team, but by choosing to be on your team, I accept some responsibility to you, my teammate. And with that means I got to pull my weight. And, you know, as a parent, that's one kind of weight that you've been pulling in for a lot of years. But I think that, you know, as we look to those transition years, we're starting to look at a point where there's going to be other people involved potentially with our kids. And then I think it's really important that we start saying, so you want to join our team. What's your responsibility? What role are you going to play? How are you going to be contributing to our team? And that languaging that is so important for the relationship you build with your child will remain important for the relationship that you build with the other support people and that they build with your child. Because I think that one of the big aspects of transitioning to adulthood is helping other teammates come on board and understand what this is going to look like uniquely for your child. And I think sometimes the best way we can do that is be that and bring them on board with the language and with that is because I think sometimes, especially when you're working with other professionals, trying to explain to them, oh no, we work this way. This is how we do it, whatever. They don't listen all that well. I don't know what your experience is, but I find, you know, there's not always some nice reciprocity. It's like, no, I know my job is. So I find that when we start using your language of team, that it becomes a different, all of a sudden, even the people enter that system a little bit differently, because all of a sudden we're pulling together towards common goals, shared understandings. What? Okay. So wow. What does a win really look like?
Let's take a quick break.
Hey, my name is Oscar, and I'm the host of the Potter Discussion Podcast. The Potter Discussion is the ultimate Harry Potter podcast, discussing everything from Harry Potter, Fantastic Beasts, and the entire Wizarding World fandom. This isn't your everyday Harry Potter podcast, because we have regular, in-depth discussions about obscure and fascinating topics. So if you enjoy in-depth character breakdowns, Harry Potter quizzes, and you are a Harry Potter super fan, this podcast is for you. Search for the Potter Discussion Podcast in your favorite podcast app, or click the link to learn more.
Well, I love that. I mean, I wasn't even that clever. So I'm glad I have the conversation and learned some more. But, you know, I use that language at school too. Like when we have a new school, a new teacher, I send them a welcome email. I'm the parent, but I've been at that school for lots of years. So I send my teacher a welcome email and welcome to our team. We're glad to have you. And it, I mean, they love it. And because, but I really do mean it. I really do mean it. And I also take the stance of, I welcome all of your information, all of your expertise. I respect your expertise, and I have expertise as well. Let's work together toward a common right. goal. And the common goal is my child. It's not you. It's not me. It's my child.
It's my child and where they're going.
Yeah. Again, I'm on his team or I'm on her team. It's not where I think they're going. I speak life into them. I speak like what their strengths are. You like to wake up early in the morning and you like this and you like that. I think, and you don't like to be around a lot of people. I think like working in a bakery might be really a cool thing for you, or maybe working in a lab might be a really good thing for you. You know, like the things that suit them, but I speak life and possibilities to let their dreams fly. I'm not creating a path. I'm just, you know, speaking. But I love that idea because, as you said, as we're walking toward the next phase of life, what I have done is onboarded some mentors in my kid's life. We're in Edmonton, and here there's that McDaniel Youth Program, and they have mentors, and they come on, but they have some experience, but they don't have expertise. They don't have maybe a great deal of expertise in FASD. And again, every person is unique. There's the characteristics. And when I first had a meeting with them, it was their language was about, we work for your child, not for you. And so we're going to be working with your child and your child's goals. And it didn't sit right. It felt divisive. And so I'm going to have a conversation with them again and say, actually, in our family, we're a team and we work together and we welcome you on our team. And I think that's the language I'm going to change. And it'll change the lens that they look through a little bit. And I know not all families are a team, but we are. And so I love that. Like, welcome to our team. You know, what role are you going to play? How are you going to support our team's goals?
And I love what you said, you know, even about the way you reach out to the teachers, because I think that it's also wonderful, because when you invite somebody to a team where you say welcome to the team or how they join the team, you can really genuinely be excited and acknowledge the fact that they will bring new skills, new ideas, and new things. Like, that's why you want, you know, people on your team, because they're going to help you advance towards, you know, the goal. Like, you want a strong team. And so as soon as you think about it, it's like, this is not about me or you. This is about the goal, which is, you know, this person here. And this is their team and their goals and their direction. And we're playing on it. And so everything you have to offer is welcome. In fact, the more you have to offer, better. This isn't a competition. This is a collaboration. This is what teams do, is we find synergies and energies together. And I appreciate that, because I think that that allows for a lot of space for the unique expertise that everybody's going to bring, as opposed to feeling as though, I think sometimes we get into, you know, like this divisive space you're referring to. And I think sometimes people get a little territorial. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes people, you know, for our own reasons and things like that, you know, might put our own needs and goals first and somehow feel that, you know, we need to look good or we need to feel good about the things that are going on. And I think that that can be really tricky. And creating a team context, you know, allows for some diffusion of that maybe while still allowing them to feel kind of good, because everybody feels good when the team wins.
And everybody looks good when the team wins. And some people are worried about how they look, but you look good when the team wins. And especially if you weren't the center of the team, if that child, that individual who you are supporting. And I'm now, as I'm thinking about this language and as you're affirming the language, I'm thinking going forward with my children, because as they become adults, I'll have an entirely different role to play and they will continue to need teammates. And I love that.
Right.
They will continue to need teammates. They're going to have mentors for some time, but you know, at some point I think we're going to need a trusteeship to help with some money. And I would prefer that I don't wear that team responsibility, because in my opinion, I think that that might be divisive in terms of our relationship, you know? So I would rather be mom and supportive and your cheerleader and be your guider and not the person you're mad at because you don't have access to all of your money. I'd rather you be mad at somebody else about that.
It's funny. I've had that same kind of conversation. And in fact, you know, there's a few teams I have that I work on where there's just certain folks that say, okay, I'm going to be the bad guy on the team, because mm-hmm. I think that's an important role to play. Like somebody has to be the one who does say no, but then we also need to have the places and spaces for folks to go to, then to have the emotional support and the ability to navigate that no.
Yes.
So we can't just stop with no. It's not no period. It's no dot, dot, dot. Now here's your team. But sometimes you want to be really explicit and say, okay, who's comfortable being the no person here? Who's got the, you know, the skin that's a little thicker, or maybe the relationship that's maybe one step removed, or where it feels like, you know, this will be the same. Because another big one, like a trusteeship is an important kind of any kind of guardianship or trustee type relationship has to really be thought about in terms of, okay, what will this mean? And where will the tensions and power struggles arise? And how do we anticipate navigating those in a way that's still in pursuit of this person's goals? Because this is their life. So we're not taking over their life. We're just on their team. So how do we, you know, do that while assigning, you know, thinking about what kind of responsibilities might want to play in this team role that helps them continue to move forward, set their own direction?
Yeah. Like as I look forward to or consider what level of guardianship, if necessary, what level of guardianship needs to be in place or trusteeship, I can see there being power struggles there. And because of concrete thinking and that abrupt kind of response to no, I would rather be able to navigate some of those relational things and work out the why there was a no or how do we make a plan forward rather than being the one always saying no, because then it looks like and feels like my mom is trying to control my life. And I really don't want to be controlling anybody's life. You know, I'd rather you all just go fly and leave me the heck alone, but that's not how it's going to work.
Well, you know, and at the end of the day, we can't control other people's lives. We might for a little while, we might think we've got it under control. We won't, because eventually that will break down. And the, you know, it's like, you know, you say the harder you hang on, the tighter that grip gets, the more likely things are to go wrong. And so this isn't about control, and teams aren't about control. Teams are about working together towards common goals. And those are goals that as people get older, individuals with FASD get older, those goals are going to be more and more their goals. It's what they want in their life. And because they've had support working through and thinking about those goals, and they're able to articulate those goals and set those goals, this is a team that's helping them achieve those goals. This isn't a team controlling what those goals are. You know, this is, and I think that's a fine line. Like you know, we talk a bit about nuances, you know, in parenting, transitioning to adulthood, all of these pieces, there's nuances. And I think that's something that we always have to kind of pause and reflect on, because we want to provide support. We want our team to be effective, but we also need for this individual to feel a sufficient amount of autonomy. They have to feel that I may have FASD, but I have a certain amount of control over me, my life, my future, because that's a necessary element of being a healthy human being. If I don't feel like I have any control, then I kind of am like, well, then what's the point of me? Because then I can have no purpose and no meaning, because I'm nothing. I'm just buoyed by the system. You know, I'm kind of just out there doing what other people tell me. So there is an element of autonomy that is absolutely essential for individuals. But like everything, it's not black and white. It's not all or none. It's nuanced, it's subtle, and how that looks and how that's expressed and how that's realized for an individual is going to be very different as our individuals with FASD are. But I think that a team can be an effective way to promote and support autonomy without kind of stepping over those lines of, okay, control and control battles, and because that's where the relationships and that healthy nature of that team. And, you know, if I were to, you know, we talk about metaphors or analogies all the time, right? We love it. And you look at a team, and my kiddos, they were soccer players. I'm in a hockey community, but my kids played soccer. And, you know, you'd have a team where everybody played really well together, and they shared and they moved things and they could score, and that worked really well. And then you get a team where you get kind of your ball hog, and they want to hold the ball, control the game. Maybe they're an all-star. Maybe they're like a super great player, but they always want to control the play. Everything has to be their way, and they're angry. It's not, that's not a team that's going to win. They don't win for long. Your ball hog does not, you know, it might take you through a few games. You might win for a little while, but as soon as you get to those more competitive levels, the teams with the really controlling players are not the ones that win. It's the teams who genuinely know what it means to kind of pursue the bigger goal, which is that success of that individual, their autonomy, their own life course, their own path, and finding what that looks like for them, with them. And I think that takes us back to even an earlier comment you said, and I don't even remember when you said it because my mind is, you know, popcorn brain here, but, you know, is that co-creation, that collaborative thinking, that way when you really have that healthy relationship with kiddos, then you can create space where you start to imagine ideas. Well, what about this? What about this? Where you can work through, just like you can work through challenges and problem solving, you can work through future planning and anticipating. Well, what feels good? What feels meaningful? Like, you have so much to offer. You can have purpose and meaning. You can impact the world in your way. How? What would that look like? What would that feel like? Those are conversations you can have with kids when you have those relational close dynamics, because then it's not an overwhelming and scary conversation. It's kind of fun and creative and I could do that. Oh, cool.
Yeah. Like speaking life into the kids, but also having that openness to, it's your life. It's your path forward. And this last year of podcasting, I've had the opportunity to speak to a number of adults who have FASD from a number of different backgrounds and lived experience of supportive and unsupportive child and youths and like adolescent times. And all of these people have been absolutely remarkable and found their own path and made their own life. And it's just taught me so much that really our kids will do. They will make their own path forward. And so I'd rather be on the team and collaborating and cooperating with them and maybe save them from some of those predictable pitfalls so that those don't have to ensnare them for a time and delay their development or set them off on another path. Can we just fill in some of those potholes a little bit, and so that they are able to, you know, be their full selves?
Absolutely. I agree completely.
Wonderful. Here's another thing that I think it brings me to the thought about anxiety. And we know that anxiety is all the people I've spoken to, anxiety has been a tremendous factor in their lives. Some have, like RJ Formanek, have really overcome anxiety with learning about metacognition and learning about how to think and controlling his own thinking. I think it also takes a great deal of maturity to get there. That's not something that perhaps a 16-year-old is going to be able to do, but we can be modeling, like you did, model, like, I'm actually not going to participate in that argument. Like, I'm actually not going to respond to that and choose to ignore. And so we could be modeling, how do we handle anxiety? How do we think? Over time, our kids will gain that skill too. But I also think if we can remain in, for as much as possible, in a positive, open relationship with our kids, that also decreases the amount of anxiety they experience.
Yeah, I agree. I think the nature of the relationship creates, you know, more space and more comfort in a setting. I think that you know, one of the things you can also do is think about those things that feel good for an individual, like any individual, and proactively do those things regularly and identify and name them as, these are my relaxing things. These are the things that take, you know, even if you think about, we can use words like anxiety, or we can use words like, sometimes kids, depending on who they are and how they like to, they'll describe it more physically, knots in my stomach, and then I'm angry at everybody, or, you know, whatever their language is, are things that when you're not feeling those knots, what are you doing? What kind of activities are you doing? What are the things that are happening? Because then you can do more of those things. So you're right. There's a certain maturity to managing anxiety in a kind of proactive and integrated way. And that's hard to do for any of us, actually. None of us, you know, it's tricky. But we can do things in terms of how our day-to-day looks that help us to just reduce it. And a big part of that comes back to those relationships and having safety in my space. Predictability and safety in my space is really important too. A lot of times our kiddos, and I think you were talking about your son when you were talking about how he's constantly sort of on the lookout, just almost see, am I doing something wrong? Am I doing it right? Am I, like, there's like this elevated sense of fearfulness that maybe I've misinterpreted, maybe I got it wrong, or because the world doesn't always make sense, like we've said. So they're constantly vetting where we might go through a day and interpretation happens kind of naturally. We don't even know when we're doing it. Our brains just kind of keep putting pieces together and then we respond and our brains put the pieces together. For kids with FASD or individuals with FASD, the pieces aren't coming together. The pieces are all over here. So they're constantly trying to put those puzzle pieces together so they know how to respond, or which puzzle piece am I supposed to pay attention to? What am I supposed to be looking at? So the more the world can, or the more their environments can be predictable, the more they can have some expectation that they recognize, the less they're doing that dart and try to figure out what to expect. So I think we can do things like that, safe relationship, consistent environment, which we talk about all the time, but we don't necessarily always talk about why it matters, right? And it's huge for reducing that stress and anxiety. And then we embed those anxiety reducing kinds of activities because they feel really good. And we talk about it as doing, these are things we do not only because they feel good, but when we do it, it also brings all those emotions down. These are good things to do.
Mm-hmm. I think that's the part that we often miss, is making the link.
Like, let's link it.
I think that, and that helps parents to understand too. Like for me, for, you know, one of the things we've had for a long time, high degree of structure in the house and a high degree of routine. And it even became important because of my son's inability to like feel that life is predictable, feel like the day is predictable. We even got to the point of scheduling suppers are the same. Like, so Monday has been spaghetti and meatballs for, I think, 6 years. It's important to ground him. For him, it's important to have the same breakfast every day, to have the same lunch every day. And if you think about, okay, that's just like, it's safe, it's predictable, I'm not having to make choices, I don't have to adjust. It's just creating like a thinking free environment for him, an ability just to, I can just be available to this without having to like worry about anticipating and there being something in my lunch I don't like, and then having to adjust. Take some of those brain, I don't know the word is, you know what the word is.
Well, it reduces demands on any kind of integration. We're constantly integrating information. And part of that is, what am I eating? What am I looking at? But I always talk about puzzles because it's kind of, I mean, a way of thinking about it. And every moment of our life, our brain is actually assembling a puzzle. They're saying, here's a piece of information, here's a piece of information. And they put it together. Our brain forms a little picture and that picture tells us what to do, right? It's like, oh, well, here's all these pictures of fuzzy and teeth and claws and hair. And oh, it's a kitten. Oh, pet the kitten. Oh, it's a happy moment. But if you have FASD and those pieces aren't coming together, you know, you're not able to integrate. It takes way more time to even pull some of the pieces together. It's hard. You've managed to pull some together. All you've got are claws and teeth. You don't even know you've got a kitty cat. You just got something pretty scary. So now you're reacting, you're anxious because you didn't even get the whole picture. So what structure and routine do is they reduce the size of the puzzle. So instead of doing a 1,000-piece puzzle, you're doing a 500-piece puzzle or a 20-piece puzzle. So the more we can structure, the less pieces that that child has to assemble. And there'll still be pieces to assemble. Weather will still be different. Your clothing might look different. You know, there's still pieces, but there's less. And so there's a little bit more success and there's less room for error. It's less likely that I'm only going to see the teeth and claws and think I'm being threatened as opposed to the fuzzy kitten that needs a hug. So if I can structure a safe environment, create predictable food, predictable activities, the same time, the same routines, I have less pieces to deal with. Yay. awesome. And the brain is like, oh, do this a little faster and a little more successfully and a little bit more accurately. Stress levels go down.
Stress levels go down. The brain calms down. We're building some other neural pathways that like, oh, I can be successful at this. I'm building some skills instead of panic.
That's right.
We have all of that. And it still goes a little sideways when even just yesterday, here's an example. Routine was set. We had supper. It was Monday. We had spaghetti and meatballs. And it was my daughter who is, by the end of the day, she's 17. And by the end of the day, her capacity is very much diminished. She's just tired and doesn't even want to put the puzzle pieces together. And we respect and honor that. Here's a foible I made. Her job was to help clean up supper. So she was to wipe the kitchen counters. Her sister was washing the table. But then at the same time, somebody handed her a plate to clean. So now, and then I was on the other side of the kitchen muttering something about, oh, this part has to be cleaned too. I was really speaking to myself, but to her, it was, you had one instruction. Now you're given a plate. And now mom's muttering something else about doing something else. And she, boom.
That was it.
Absolutely. Now, because I know what happened, I turned around and I said, I'm sorry. I was speaking to myself. And meanwhile, she's hollering at me, which is okay. Hollering at me. You told me to do this. And now you want me to do this. And I don't know what to do. And that's exactly the point. Mm-hmm. All these puzzle pieces, all this information coming in and the inability to sequence, the inability to remember, I have to do 1, 2, 3 and the order in which to do 1, 2, 3. I recognize that's what's happening. So I took that ownership on, and it was interesting after she got through it. And I gave her space. I apologized and said that I was actually talking to me. I wasn't talking to you. And then I backed off because she needs space now to re-regulate and calm back down. My husband said to me after, he goes, you know, you shouldn't do that. I'm like, yeah, I shouldn't do that. But he goes, you should actually look at her when you're speaking, because he was standing next to her and he could see her shoulders go up and her back kind of arch. And then she reacted. So it was really interesting that he had that observation to share that with me. So again, it always comes back to me. They're right. It really is all my fault. They are right. But it's about modifying the environment, right? Being aware of what the triggers are.
Well, and what a lovely observation, you know, to see the physical reaction, because our kids message in a lot of different ways. And you know, I got to say, what an awesome thing. I think that there's a lesson for all of us as parents in this. There is tremendous power in an apology. And I think that there's times and places where, and I've heard it even in raising my kids, like, why would you apologize to your child? You're the parent. They should be the one apologizing. Again, we're back to that. Your team, my team, we're back to that. But sometimes the idea of an apology seems to carry something. I think there's tremendous power in a parent that says, oh, I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I think it's just amazing. And I feel like sometimes as parents, we're like, we don't even allow ourselves the space to make mistakes, let alone tell anyone else about it, you know? And I think that's so wonderful that you do that. You model it for your kids. You make it completely okay to apologize. There's nothing shameful or wrong about saying, oh, I made a mistake. It's what a wonderful thing. Oh, I made a mistake. Because then when they make mistakes, it's okay.
Yeah.
Just like they make mistakes. We all make mistakes. So now you've normalized it. You've given, again, you're in the language, you're modeling it. You're not only de-escalating a situation, modeling, healthy behavior and reducing some of the shame and stigma that sometimes comes with making a mistake. Like, it's wonderful.
Cool. Here I'm like, look how I screwed up again. But it isn't like, cause we're all learning and growing and we do make mistakes. And I say like, yeah, like my kids, you know, if they are upset that they made a mistake, I'm like, that's okay. Nobody's perfect. I make mistakes all the time. Right. And they're like, oh yeah, when you do this and you do this, they'll just lay it on. I'm like, exactly. Nobody's perfect. It's okay. Yeah.
How great is that? And clearly, if they layer it on, they're noticing. And they're not noticing it because you're bad. They're noticing it because it's registering with them. Oh, wait, mom makes mistakes and mom is amazing. So therefore, if we make mistakes, we can still be amazing. Oh, wait, okay.
Oh, that's funny. That's funny.
What a wonderful model.
Here's another wonderful model. It's a little crooked, but it's kind of a wonderful model. But, you know, that makes sense for me. But my son, I was telling you earlier, my son has this negative self-talk, you know, like ever since he was, since he could talk, it seemed like, well, his first word was broken. So that might have something to do with it because he was breaking everything. But his first default was always, I'm bad. I'm bad boy, bad boy. And I've never said that to him, but that was his own self-talk. So a number of years ago now, maybe when he's about 8 or something like that, I started saying, you know, you are amazing. I've always praised him, but I said, you're amazing. Do you know why you're amazing? He'd look at me. And I really didn't believe this about myself, but I would say, because I'm amazing. You have such an amazing mom. That's why you're amazing. And I really didn't believe that about myself. I'm really self-critical, but I thought I'm going to model this and see what happens. Well, and it's awesome. And I also learned about self-care and about modeling. Like, so I do model, like I praise myself for making dinner. Like, wow, I did a good job on dinner today, because they're not going to. So, I, you know, but it also, it's modeling appropriate social interaction. It's modeling self-affirmations. It's modeling all sorts of things that I didn't know I was doing. It was just this little crooked experiment I thought I would try, but it was really, but now they think I'm amazing and they think they're amazing.
That's right.
Hey, what an amazing team we have.
Well, and you know what I love also, that the things that you're also picking things you do. I did this and this is great. I did great. So I think sometimes when we think about strengths or people are amazing, whatever, we throw it out like, oh, hey, you're here. You are amazing. Like there's nothing hung on it. Like there's no reasons, right? Or our strengths and success talk can be kind of empty, but we're really good at being particular and specific when we're criticizing, right?
Yeah. Like
we criticize really directly. And so I think that, you know, being specific and acknowledging, hey, I did this really well, not only is modeling that success and that nice affirmation, which we should all get better at, frankly, but it's also hanging it on a specific action. So it makes it so that success and strengths are as tangible and identifiable as those problems and issues. And, you know, and we don't always keep those in balance, because sometimes the problems are so loud and so big that it's really easy to be quite specific about those, but to be equally loud and specific about, you know, I did the dishes and they look great. Awesome. And it's true. And it's specific and it's there. And I'm not saying we have to yell everything, but you get my drift. It really creates a more tangible sense of what strengths are and what success looks like, because then our kids can live it and see it because they're concrete in many cases. And oh, wait a minute. There it is. It's not some abstract whatever.
I was just going there, my thought, because our kids don't abstract from the external. They don't abstract from, oh, mom said I'm great. Why did she say I'm great? You know, but, and abstract even, what is that desired behavior? Like, good job. What? You know, but if I can be concrete and specific, then I am praising and praising the specific skill, even whether that's that self-regulation. Like that's been an amazing to see that grow in my kids and go, wow, like I know you're upset and you didn't yell. That I'm so proud of you. Well done. You know, and be able to praise that and acknowledge that they're still uncomfortable. They're still like, ah, but they were able to use, you know, or they're exasperated about something and like, they, instead of like hollering at a sibling, they can go, mom, I need help with this, you know, like mom is usually what it sounds like, but you know, they're asking for help and I can say, thanks for asking for help rather than getting into a fight with your sibling. But but that's the thing, is learning to be specific. And I don't think that comes easily to any of us.
So nice. And no. And either referring to our kids or ourselves, which is again, why it's here you doing it. It's both ways. I don't think we're as good at it, but I love it. And I love that you catch them doing good, right? Thanks for using your words. Thanks for asking for help. Great job doing this. And, you know, and even when kiddos, sometimes they'll be yelling and you're like, do I say stop yelling? Or do I say, I'm really glad you're using your voice to ask for help, right? Which side of the coin do you want to pick? Pick the part of it you want to see more of.
Yes.
And the more we highlight and cast attention on the things we like to see, and we want to see more of those strengths, those capacities, the more we're going to see them. And that really is back to those old days of behavior modification. That really is about reinforcing or strengthening those things that we want to see more of. And there is actually great evidence for that as well, that it's when we reinforce and we try to strengthen the strengths, the positive things, that we see the most growth. Punishment is not an effective behavior change strategy. It does not work. It doesn't work well for anyone. It's never been demonstrated to be long-lasting or meaningful. No, it doesn't work. Anything that tries to suppress or get rid of a behavior doesn't work. Our options are understand the behavior so that we might get to the root of it and get a better sense of what might really be going on, and then we can kind of co-create pathways forward. Or catch them getting things right and reinforce those successes and pull out the positive aspect and reinforce and strengthen that. Those are the things that actually help influence outcomes for our kiddos. Get a good understanding.
Yeah.
Catch them good.
Love it. Well, and it reminds me of like a dopamine hit, right? Like if somebody smiles at you and engages with you and compliments you, whatever, dopamine hit. Well, right? Let's do that. Because if you tell me I'm good at something, I'll try it again. If you tell me I'm not good at something and criticize me, I don't want to be a fool. I don't want to look bad. I'm not going to do it.
Agreed.
Except for make dinner. Apparently, I still have to make dinner every night. But aside from that.
Yeah, there are always the things. But
there are the things.
No, reinforcement is powerful and it feels good. And it does. It does create an... And when it's paired, especially with efforts to understand, because, you know, if we're not understanding what's going on, sometimes it's hard for us to reinforce because we don't know what's desired and we don't understand why our kiddos might be struggling or why they might be lashing out or what might be happening. So we need to be patient and we need to be able to do, as you've suggested, observe, pay attention, ask questions. When they're calm, let's have a conversation. Let's try to understand. Tell me more. Help me to understand. Help me make sense of this. Right? Where we value their voice and their perspective and accept they know themselves better than we do. So maybe together we can kind of figure out a better path forward. So that understanding piece, so important. And then as they start to kind of get some traction, reinforce some more.
Absolutely. And because what are we doing? Like, we're not raising children, we're raising adults. And they're going to get there. They're going to get there. So let's give them some skills. They're always going to need support. We all need support. I don't want to be in this world alone either. You know, we all need support, but let's reinforce those skills and also reinforce that their voice matters. That's always been so imperative to me, to my kids, that their voice matters from the little things in toddlerhood to, you know, such as like, stop tickling me. Like those little things and like, or I don't like to eat peas, you know, like whatever, your voice matters. That's important. And now as they move on and then we see problem behaviors in our kids and sometimes we don't give them a voice. We're just like, stop it, knock it off. I don't want to see any more of that or else. I mean, I'm guilty of all of those things. But when I can also say to them, like, I see this is hard for you. What do you need? Or that, I bet you that didn't go the way you thought it was going to go, you know? Then I create space to listen and to learn and to grow and then to build some skills with them.
I think you're wise. I think the more we can get out of, you know, those battles for control and those, efforts to assert our authority or something, it just doesn't work. Folks cornered do not respond well. It doesn't create conditions for understanding or behavior change at all. And, you know, telling people what not to do may create a lot of anxiety and bad feelings, but it doesn't actually help them understand what they should be doing. And if they don't actually themselves understand why they're doing what they're doing, then they have no idea what the alternative is. So all you've done really is help them to feel badly and elevate the anxiety with no sense of what the alternative is or even why things are going the way they're going. So now I'm confused, afraid, and, you know, and feeling kind of lousy. And pretty soon I'm going to say, well, what's the point anyway? And then at some point you're going to say, well, the world's unpredictable. Nothing makes sense. So I might as well do the only thing I know that actually gets me any kind of control over my world. And even if it's bad and gets me sent to the principal office or gets me in trouble, at least it was predictable. at least I knew when I did this, this would happen, as opposed to trying something and working really hard and wanting to do well and having it go south and then actually feeling really badly about myself as well. So at least if it's bad, at least I can be good at being bad.
Well, yeah, I saw that in my firstborn, who is neurotypical and in grade one, she, really strong-willed child, and her teacher, she just got in trouble all the time at school, and it wasn't even by Christmas. And she's like, well, like I could see it happen in her. She didn't have the words to say this, but if you think I'm going to be bad, I might as well be bad and have fun, because I'm going to get in trouble anyway. And her whole grade 1 year, she spent in trouble at school, and it was ridiculous. But as lots of times the big people set that stage for that exactly to happen. And as you were talking about, the world is unpredictable and it doesn't make sense. And no matter how hard I try, it just doesn't work. And then I feel bad. And then of course the relationships in the family fall apart. So now we have no relational safety. And doesn't it make sense then that our kids that are already vulnerable don't turn to substances to soothe themselves, to escape the pain? And our kids are so vulnerable to that already.
Absolutely. And it is, it's a great escape. It makes it all, I don't feel badly anymore. And it's a group of friends who will have something to friends. I'm using air quotes here, but
yeah,
but it is peers who it's a peer group, are similarly, yeah. It is. And they're similarly marginalized, and they are similarly feeling they don't fit within the system. And so they'll accept them. And our kids want to be accepted. They want relationships. You know, if there's one, you know, thing that we say over and over again, we've talked about it nonstop here, is individuals with FASD are highly relational. That's why relational supports work. Peers matter. People are important. People are important. There's lots of research showing that as well, right? I mean, even when we did resiliency work, the number one resiliency strength in individuals with FASD, relationships and the capacity for relationship. Number one, powerful. But that goes both ways, because when I'm not fitting in and I'm not working, then I'm going to fit in with those peers that provide that relational connection and meaning. And if that means drugs, or if that means crime, or if that means, yeah, I'll steal the car with somebody because then they'll like me, that's what I'm going to do. And it's not because I don't care about who owns the car. It's nothing to do with these, you know, usual attributions of the relationship. These are really central. And this seems to be the best way to do it, and certainly the only way I know of, and nobody's given me an alternative. So I agree. I think, and it's not to say everything's cut and dried like this. And I keep using the word nuanced, because I really want to say that there's no formula, there's no recipe, but we're talking about some of the really important ingredients. Recognizing relationships matter and that space for co-creation might allow us to get on board earlier and leverage some of these potential advantage points before they turn into these higher risk situations.
Yes, 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 yes. And even if we do, it's like, okay, I'm going to say it's like baking a cake, because I'm a really crap baker. So I'm going to put all the ingredients in. 30% of the time it's going to work. I hate baking, but parenting kind of like that, you know, in some ways. But if we do all this work though, if we're creating, working hard to have this trusted, safe relationship, and we as parents, we mess it up. Our kids don't always have capacity because of their own trauma, their own brain differences, their own body differences. They may lack capacity too, but I have seen in my own life though, I've had my daughter who was an addiction for over 10 years, lived on the streets, lots of trauma, lots of criminality, lots of all sorts of things. Now we're through that and we have a beautiful, rich family relationship. So even if it does go sideways for a time, maintain your hope, take care of your mental health, mama and daddy, like take care of yourself, do the work you need to do so that you'll be able to receive that child back when they come to see if this is still a safe place to be.
That's
and
right.
As they stumble and fall their way through rehab and recovery and relapse, and as they stumble their way through, and it's so heartbreaking, it can just take you down. It does take you down, but there is hope too for a rich family life after.
Absolutely. That's so beautifully said. And beautifully shared. I think that nothing is inevitable. Nothing here is predetermined, right? And you do what you can do and do the very best you can do in building those healthy relationships and creating that space and taking care of yourselves, because that is essential. Self-care is critical. Without that, you've got nothing. And then, when things go sideways, when it goes the wrong way, it's not your fault. It's nobody's fault. It's just the way it went. And that's what happens. We don't have to look for people to blame. We don't have to worry about responsibility. Let's get healthy. Let's take care of ourselves. And let's just stay ready to love this person when they're ready to come back, when they're ready to re-engage. And relationships can be repaired and restored, and hope is, powerful part of that.
It is, and it's hard to find, hard to have in those years. And you see your child suffering, and you don't know what the end is going to be. It's incredibly hard, but having lived through it and see my daughter do so well now, and us having intentionally repaired the relationship and have a rich mother-daughter relationship is just, it's so rewarding. I can't be grateful for the experience, but I can be grateful to have had the experience in order to give other people hope that recovery is possible for individuals. And I've learned that from many people with FASD, recovery is possible. And relationships are so important for all of us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hands Jackie, down. Thanks so much for your time and your expertise. And I come through it with my mom language and my mom lived experience. And then you just package it all up nice and love it. Appreciate it so much.
Well, it's a pleasure. You know what? I got to tell you though, I think about a half as a mom too, right? Like,
yeah. Oh yeah. Your mom language comes through too.
But yeah, wonderful conversation. I could just go all day. I think we both could.
We could. As I wrap up that episode, I have to again say thank you to Dr. Jacqueline Pye for sharing her time with me and her expertise and coaching me through. I mean, that was a completely unscripted conversation. Some of it felt like sharing it. Some of it felt like a counseling appointment. I mean, it was kind of everything. I hope you enjoyed it. I learned a lot. Did you learn a lot? What did you learn? What was your takeaway? Let me know at fasdfamilylife@gmail.com. For me, one of the aha moments was when Dr. Jacqueline Pye said that the most profound approach to helping kids with FASD improve their math skills, slow it down and ask, show me how you did that, as a way to understand the kid's thinking process. And you know, you and I could generalize that to other aspects. It doesn't just have to be math. It could be other problem solving, other things that come up. And that was a real big moment for me. And I value that. I wonder what you took away from the episode. I'd love to hear about it. If you have suggestions for other episodes or guests you think I should have on the show, let me know. Because you know what? This show is for families, by families, raising kids with FASD. So I want to hear from you. Write to me at fasdfamilylife@gmail.com. And now let me check in with you. How are you doing? Do you have friends that you can relate with, friends who understand what it is like to raise kids with a neurodiversity? If you don't, if you're looking for that, if you want to meet other parents raising kids with FASD, subscribe to the FASD Family Life community for only $10 a month. You will be invited to join our monthly online support group on Microsoft Teams. Our support group is fun. It's a lively place to connect with other parents who get it. And we have group members from all over the world. Sign up today and be a part of our next meeting. There's a link in the show notes for you. As I was saying, September is FASD Awareness Month. And one of the big events that's happening is Run Fast. Run FASD 2022. It's just around the corner, and I want to invite you to join the FASD Family Life team for Run Fast. There's a link in the show notes so that you can register. And the organizers of this event have swag for you to buy too. They have t-shirts and medals and race pennies. So whatever kind of swag you want to get, you can purchase that when you register Run, Walk, or Roll for Run FASD 2022. Run FASD embodies strength, tenacity, empowerment, hope, and a vision. A virtual 5K event that can happen at your own pace wherever you are. From September 9th to September 25th, 2022, Run FASD to bring awareness to fetal alcohol spectrum disorders. This is the dream of author, runner, and FASD self-advocate Rebecca Talou, who has been on the show before. Run FASD encourages people with FASD, their allies, and supporters to make this invisible disability visible. This virtual 5K can be completed at a walk, a run, or a roll in your own time and at your own pace. Can't run or walk? No problem. You can still donate to support FASD. Register for Coach Rebecca's virtual 5K Run FASD and join runners, walkers, and bikers from around the world while raising awareness for FASD. And like I said, there's a link in the show notes so you can join the FASD Family and Life team that is running, walking, or rolling for Run FASD 2022. September's right around the corner, and you know, that's busy time. Some of you all have had your kids go back to school. The rest of us, our kids are going back to school September 1st. It's going to be full on. September is also FASD Awareness Month. So that's going to be the emphasis of the FASD Family Life podcast for the month. I'm going to be showcasing what's happening for FASD awareness. And then after that, I'm launching the FASD Family Life Podcast World Tour. I'm going to bring you information from all around the world, and not just information, but success stories. I'm going to be talking to people who have FASD in a variety of different countries. I'm going to be talking to researchers and service providers to raise awareness that FASD is a global health issue. There's action happening globally. Things are happening. There's a momentum happening. And so let's link arms together and build a community to raise awareness for FASD and change the conversation. We know the struggle is real, and so is success. So let's get loud, let's raise that awareness, and let's change the conversation about FASD. So make sure you subscribe, because you don't want to miss any episodes of the FASD Family Life Podcast as we go on our world tour. Thanks for spending your time with me. I know it's precious. And until next week, remember, the struggle is real, and so is success. I'll speak with you soon.